Dodgers, starring Campbell Scott, on Saturday, November 15th at 9 p.m. Listings at SundanceChannel.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ask Democratic presidential contender Dennis Kucinich about weapons of mass destruction, and he is likely to talk about poverty. That, he says, is the real weapon of mass destruction in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. That kind of talk has left the Ohio congressman deep in the polls, but high in the hearts of diehard fans tonight on Point. A conversation with Dennis Kucinich on his political quest and vision for America. But first, we begin in Washington, where Paul Bremer was in emergency meetings at the White House today on the deteriorating situation in Iraq. In Nasiriyah, at least 26 people, including at least 18 Italians, were killed when a truck bomb exploded in that southeastern Iraqi city. In Baghdad, explosions and gunfire marked U.S. military raids on suspected guerrilla strongholds. Joining me live to talk about today's developments is John Diamond, Pentagon reporter for USA Today. Good evening and welcome, John Diamond.
Great to be here.
John, what's emerging from Paul Bremer's meetings in Washington today?
Go faster is the word from President Bush to Bremer in terms of transitioning to an Iraqi-controlled government. Exactly how that may happen was not made clear. The White House is operating under some level of secrecy, not even consulting their Republican friends on Capitol Hill as to what's going on. But they're kicking around a variety of ideas, including an interim president, following a model that would be similar to what the United States did in Afghanistan, to get some sort of Iraqi authority under singular leadership up and running. To speed the transition to Iraqi control of the situation. And, of course, this would mirror what's going on the military side with an attempt to accelerate the training of Iraqi forces to get them into the field. And, indeed, we saw hundreds of Iraqi police in house-to-house raids into Crete today.
John, what is the advantage that acceleration is supposed to bring?
Well, one advantage may be political for President Bush, of course, in terms of transitioning out of a situation where the United States is solely responsible, apparently, for what's going on. It would essentially be an attempt to take the target off the back of the United States in terms of what's going on in Iraq, to give Iraqis a sense that they control their own destiny, to enhance the notion of legitimacy in the government of Iraq, as opposed to the notion of it being sort of a puppet creation of the United States. And, of course, there are, hand-in-hand with that, risks, such as that going faster will mean that there will be an attempt to impose a democracy before the country is really ready for it, before there's been sufficient stability. Another major risk, of course, is that you could see the Shia population assert its political strength and seize political control, and that could lead things in a more radical Islamic direction that would be antithetical to U.S. interests.
And John, is there a sense that the U.S. occupation has a good partner in Iraq for speeding up Iraqification, to use that word, in the Iraqi General Council?
Well, there is a great deal of friction going on right now between the U.S. the coalition authority and the Iraqi government interim authority that's in power. This council, the governing council, that was established at the end of fighting last spring. The Bush administration seems to believe that this council is in disarray, that many of its members have been out of the country and not involved in goings-on, that they've been out making speeches and, for example, Ahmad Shalabi of the Iraqi National Congress spending a lot of time in New York and on Capitol Hill meeting with his contacts and not a lot of time in Iraq. Members of the council fire back that the United States has been clumsy in its handling of things, has not been responsive to its demands. Indeed, none of this was helped along today when U.S. troops accidentally fired on a car that was carrying Mohammed Bakr al-Hun, a member of the Iraqi Governing Council, wounding his driver. So there's a great deal of tension right now and a sense on the part of the Bush administration that the council is simply not in control.
And, John, you're at the Pentagon looking over those 130,000-some U.S. troops there. What's the military, U.S. military view? What would they like to see happen here?
There is a great interest in turning over more authority to Iraqi forces. One great benefit of this would be an increase in valuable human intelligence, because of course the Iraqis have command of the language, know the neighborhoods, know the culture, whereas the American forces generally are in the dark about subtleties of that kind, and they're having a hard time picking up good intelligence about some of the guerrilla attacks and the guerrilla fighters that they're up against. U.S. intelligence has had a hard time simply identifying the enemy they're fighting. There are risks here that some of these Iraqi fighters would be put into the field with poor training, that some of them might be working for the other side. And of course, in the short term, there has been in recent days an intensification of U.S. Attacks, such as use of air power, helicopter gunships, etc. And there's a risk inherent there in that that could increase resentment, popular resentment against the Americans, even though in the short term, greater use of force may be what's needed to stop these guerrilla attacks.
So a sense that the U.S. may have to pivot in its policy somehow, but they're not showing the details of their thinking tonight.
That's right.
John Diamond, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
John Diamond is Pentagon reporter for USA Today. He joined me from Washington. A city councilman at 23, mayor of Cleveland at 31, U.S. congressman at 50, Democratic presidential candidate at 57. The son of a truck-driving union man, Dennis Kucinich, has spent his political career battling for an unapologetically progressive agenda. His presidential campaign platform is poles apart from the GOP and from many of his Democratic contenders. He is against the World Trade Organization. He wants the U.S. out of Iraq and the U.N. in. He is for a universal single-payer health care system. He is the only candidate who voted in Congress not to invade Iraq. Supporters call him a true Democrat, a real alternative to Bush. Polls put him at the bottom of the pack, running neck and neck with Carol Moseley Braun. But Kucinich doesn't quit. This proud, progressive, strict, vegan, divorced, and single Ohioan says he's fighting for a different America. Tonight, in our series of conversations with the Democratic challengers, Dennis Kucinich. How do you read the Kucinich view of the world, and do you share it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Johnston, Iowa, is Democratic presidential candidate and Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich. Good evening and welcome, Representative Kucinich.
Good evening, and thank you for the opportunity to be on your show.
Thanks very much for having us, for joining us tonight. Also with me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Congressman.
Hi, Jack.
Dennis Kucinich, give us a report from the trail. What were you up to today? What kind of response are you getting in Iowa?
The response that I'm getting in Iowa has been increasingly positive, and the message that I have is separating me from the field. I'm right now the only person I know of in Iowa who's running for president who is calling for an end to the occupation of Iraq, bringing reaching out to the world community, getting the UN in and the U.S. out. I'm the only one who's raising questions about this document that circulated last week talking about ginning up the draft again. And I was one of three Democrats last week in the debates in New Hampshire who said that the idea of asking 18-year-old women to register for a draft is absolutely unacceptable. You know, we've got to get out of Iraq, no draft, work with the world community on matters of international security. That's the only way we're going to have a safe world and a safe nation.
We'll talk about how all that's going down, but let's go into some of the details first. You say U.S. out of Iraq, the United Nations in. What does that really mean? You've said U.S. troops out totally by New Year's. Do we have that right?
It's not that we have the right. We have an obligation to change our direction. And that means we have to go to the United Nations with a totally new resolution. And that resolution would have the following provisions: that the U.S. would give up any ambitions for controlling the oil of Iraq, for controlling a privatization process, for trying to award contracts to administrative favorites, that the U.S. would have to turn over to the United Nations those functions as well as the contracting function, and that the U.S. would turn over to the U.N. the cause of developing new governance so the Iraqi people can be self-determining. Under those circumstances, I think the world would recognize the United States has has turned over a new leaf, and that would be the reason why the UN could go to member nations and send in UN complements that would help rotate U.S. troops out.
But do we understand your position correctly? Do you literally imagine U.S. soldiers out of Iraq by New Year's Day? That's six weeks from now.
My proposal went on my website last month at Kucinich.us, and if it had been introduced and accepted last month, we could have been out by New Year's.
So you don't even imagine U.S. forces in Iraq as part of a United Nations effort?
Absolutely not. We have to get our troops are targets. And, the U.S. presence in Iraq is destabilizing in and of itself. The war is intensifying. As your analyst said, the attacks have increased. They're now using air power against Iraqi placements. We're finding that the thing is deteriorating. We've got to get our troops out of there. We've got to get the UN in and get the U.S. out. And I absolutely believe that it's possible to do that. We cannot stay in that region. We were there for the wrong reasons, and we should get out.
But Dennis Kucinich, is this the kind of position that, on the one hand, wins you some really diehard supporters to say, yes, we want to do that? On the other hand, draws critics who say that's simply not realistic, Representative Kucinich?
Well, let's talk about realism here. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, with al-Qaeda's role in 9/11, with the anthrax attack upon our country. Iraq was not trying to get uranium from Niger, had no intention or ability to attack our nation, and did not have weapons of mass destruction. So let's talk realism here.
Yeah.
It was wrong for us to go there. The United States is there based on a lie. Why should we stay there? We're there based on a lie. We have a responsibility to work with the world community. The policies of preemption and unilateralism have led us down a cul-de-sac. And now that we're in that blind alley, we need to turn back around and get out of it, work with the world community in stabilizing Iraq, but we can't do it by leaving our troops there.
Forgive me if I've got this wrong, but I think that every other Democratic contender, or at least the most prominent ones, even if they're opposed to the war, they're saying the U.S. has to stay in Iraq and see this job through. What are they misunderstanding that you see differently in that case?
Well, first of all, you're right in characterizing every other candidate on that. And, may I say, to establish a context, I led the effort in the House of Representatives a year and a half ago in challenging the Bush administration's march towards war in Iraq. And I helped to organize 126 Democrats, nearly two-thirds of the Democratic caucus, to vote against the Iraq resolution. So I'm not a newcomer to this issue.
We've got that, but why are they all on the other end of the dock here?
Because this attitude of staying the course, don't cut and run, which is now the mantra that other Democratic candidates are saying, is really a tribute to the kind of wrongheadedness which has led this country into Iraq in the first place. I guess they're afraid of looking weak. I'm saying the strength of this nation is recognizing when a mistake has been made, we shouldn't have been there, and we should get out.
You don't fear chaos in the wake of a U.S. withdrawal?
Oh, no. No, I'm not suggesting the U.S. Leave without anyone there. I'm saying that we create an agreement with the United Nations which recognizes that the U.S. has no rights to ambitions for oil or privatization of the Iraq economy, and in fact, a new approach at the UN would cause the United Nations and the member countries to participate in a stabilization of Iraq.
And you don't think that would look like the U.S. cutting and running after such a huge intervention?
Well, first of all, we're not talking about cutting and running, because we have to recognize that the U.S. has a responsibility to pay for the rebuilding of everything we destroyed in the war, to compensate Iraqi victims, and to contribute to future U.N. efforts. But we need to get our troops out of there, and we need to get our troops out of there as soon as possible.
Jack Beatty, Dennis Kucinich puts his chin right out there. He's not afraid to say it just the way he sees it, even if no one else is saying the same thing.
Yes, and I say good for him. I mean, we need to at least hear that perspective, because one of the things we learned in Vietnam was that sacrifice became the justification for yet more sacrifice and yet more sacrifice. And I hear that logic here. These men can't have died in vain, so more die. And we say again, they can't have died in vain, so more die.
But it's not just the sacrifice. People point to security on the ground. They say we can't walk away from the Iraqi people.
Sure, no, I quite agree about that. But I think he's putting his finger on how war itself and just simply the using up of troops can become a justification for keeping them there, so that the first question, the question that he's asking, should we be there, never gets asked. That was the question that never got asked about Vietnam. To raise it was people were saying, you're going to cut and run. You're going to leave the United States weaker. All these arguments. And, of course, anyone who says what Dennis says is going to hear that, too.
We're joined tonight from Johnston, Iowa, where he's campaigning by Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democratic presidential candidate. Talking with him about his political quest and his vision for the country. You can join the conversation. What's your question for Dennis Kucinich? And do you resonate with the Kucinich message, the Kucinich view of America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich about his political quest and his vision for the country. He joins us tonight from Johnston, Iowa, where he's in the midst of campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination. You can join the conversation. What's the impact of the Kucinich candidacy on the Democratic field, on the debate, on the effort to beat George Bush? And are you ready to dump NAFTA, the Iraq War, and private health care with Dennis Kucinich? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Representative Kucinich, let's look, if we may, at NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. You say let's deep six both of them. Where do you head with that?
Well, I think we need to recognize that as America faces a nearly $500 billion trade deficit, it's appropriate to take an appraisal and see how did we get there. And NAFTA has led to, I believe, a destructive undermining of our manufacturing base in particular. We've lost since July of the year 2000 nearly 3 million manufacturing jobs. And I would say hundreds of thousands of those jobs are directly attributable to NAFTA. NAFTA has inspired a race to the bottom. It was impressed on this country by global corporations who were seeking to be able to set up shop in other countries without having to worry about workers' rights, human rights, or environmental quality principles.
But, of course, that's not the way...
The WTO locks NAFTA in place.
But that's not the way it was impressed on the country. It was impressed on the country. It was sold by many, including Bill Clinton, as a way to unlock the global economy, to see trade go to new heights and everybody benefit.
Well, you know, at this point, that sounds like brilliant hyperbole. Because what you have is a case where we're losing our manufacturing base, our wages are stagnant or being driven down, the WTO is taking away our sovereignty. They just made a decision about steel tariffs the other day that forces America to choose between steel or agricultural strength. I think that we have to recognize that these global trade agreements were made to help global corporations.
What's the alternative? We're all going to darn our own socks and...
No. Well, let's go back to pre-NAFTA and pre-WTO. We weren't all darning our own socks. I mean, we, in fact, had a much stronger trade position. And as a matter of fact, we can return to bilateral trade where we can set the conditions. See, Lester Thoreau writes in some of his books that there has to be a correspondence between what we sell to a nation and what they buy from us. And what a nation sells to us and what we buy from them. And,
there has to be a balance overall is the ideal, right? But it doesn't matter if there's a balance in every particular relationship.
No. But what's happening, though, is that let's take China, for example. We have a trade deficit with China, which is $130 billion. And the trade deficit with Mexico is staggering. And our trade deficits keep deepening because we have encouraged a race to the bottom by not having any protections for workers' rights or human rights or the environment.
How do you shut this trade regime down without throwing the world into a global depression, shutting down trade, repeating that whole cycle?
You go back to bilateral trade. I mean, everyone wants access to the United States markets. We all understand that. People want to do business with the U.S. This is the largest consumer market. But we have the right to be able to determine the circumstances. I mean, if we're buying from your country, then you should buy from us. And that's not happening, and because the global corporations who stand behind all these agreements want to make it possible for the American people to buy cheap goods made in other countries where the corporations make a huge profit because they pay people next to nothing.
But does that mean Americans won't be able to shop at Walmart anymore and buy $9 blue jeans?
Well, it means that we should be able to buy blue jeans that we make in this country, and it certainly means we should be able to buy steel products we make in this country since we're a major consumer of steel goods. We've lost 30 steel mills in a period of a few years. And I think that you have to remember we're losing good-paying jobs. our whole middle-class way of life is getting is under attack because of trade agreements that have been constructed deliberately as a way to drive down wages here and to be able to move good-paying jobs out of the country and then create a cheap source of labor in other countries and then sell the products back here at a huge profit.
Boy, but as we speak with Lester Thoreau on this program, I hear him awfully strong in favor of globalization. He's saying regulate it well, watch it, be careful with it, but there's no choice but to go this way.
Well, wait a minute. You know, but he has said there has to be some correspondence. There is no correspondence. I mean, people, we have countries that are flooding our markets with products, but they're not buying from us. And, so he's right about that, but let's talk about what's actually happening here. You know, the WTO has set an order to the United States saying you either drop tariffs on steel or we're going to penalize your agricultural products. Those tariffs on steel were set up because steel was being dumped in our markets. And why was steel being dumped in our markets and sold below the price of production? Because the IMF and the World Bank helped to construct a situation where other countries, in order to pay their debt back to the IMF or the World Bank, had to build steel mills, make steel, and pay off their debt by selling steel.
So you're on the same page as George Bush there. So you're on the same page as George W. Bush there.
I encouraged George Bush to put up the tariffs. That was part of my leadership in encouraging George Bush, and I helped to save a steel mill in Cleveland that was a victim of these dumping policies. So that's why I say we've got to cancel NAFTA and the WTO and go back to bilateral trade. And by the way, the trade agreements permit the U.S. to withdraw from them within 6 months. And I would exercise that and go back to the bilateral trade. We can choose to trade with countries and put the qualifications for access to our market. I mean, why don't we used to do that. And when we did that before, we were a lot stronger.
Well, it's been a long time and a lot of ideology and economics under the bridge since then. But let's turn, if we may, to health care. You're calling for universal health care, single-payer system. Does that mean no more private health care?
Well, no. The system that I'm asking for, which is embodied in House Resolution 676, calls for the establishment of universal health care, a single-payer system, Medicare for all, expanded Medicare for all, where everyone would be covered. It would no private health care services would be permitted to exist that would duplicate Medicare for all. So it takes our system from a for-profit system, which rations health care according to the ability to pay, to a not-for-profit healthcare system, which covers everyone.
Two things, then. First, just getting it through. You know what Bill Clinton ran into there, and all those lobbies and all that money is still out there. How would you possibly get this through?
Well, first of all, what Bill Clinton was trying to get through was HMOs. It's not what I'm talking about.
It was even less ambitious. It was more market-oriented.
But I wanted to point that out, because there is a difference.
The difference is
that I'm talking about the broadest reform, and I would go to the American people as the nominee of the party. And if I get the nominee, it means that people want the broadest possible change and reform. I'm giving them that option for my candidacy. I would ask the people to give me a Congress that would give them health care. And you know what? When Franklin Roosevelt went to the people of this country and asked them to support a New Deal, he asked for a new Congress in 1932 to make it happen, and they responded magnificently with 88 new members of the House, 13 new members of the Senate. I believe that such an appeal from the nominee, and if I'm the nominee, I'll make that appeal, will result in a political sea change in this country where the American people will at last defeat the insurance companies and the lobbyists who are stopping them from having health care.
Dennis Kucinich, does your low standing in the polls, and there's no way around it, does it indicate that the American voters are not ready for that sea change?
No, it means that I'm ready to be an overnight success. That's what it means. And it also means that my campaign is just getting started. We're organized in 50 states. We put the $4 million that we raised into a grassroots organization. And let's face it, I know I'm not a front runner, and I know that I'm seen as a long shot, but a lot of people are being drawn to my candidacy because in it they see authenticity, they see integrity, and they see hope for the future. They see really the end of fear and the beginning of hope, and that's what my campaign is about.
Jack Beatty, what do you see here, a contender, an oracle, a voice from the past, a voice of the future?
Well, I see somebody who sort of throws up for us a picture of the Democratic Party. Here's a tale of some presidents. Ronald Reagan protected the auto industry. George Bush protected the steel industry. Bill Clinton got us into the WTO, NAFTA, and normalization of trade with China. Which of these presidents was the friend of the working man? I think the Democratic Party is going to be going to a lot of voters next year saying, we will protect your jobs. and yet through Clinton. And that wing of the Democratic Party, they have done more to undermine the economic security of working Americans, people whose jobs can be replicated abroad, which is a heck of a lot of Americans, not just manufacturing workers, but people in high tech. They have done more, Bill Clinton and that wing of the party, to undermine the economic security of Americans than George Bush and his tax cuts could ever do.
But Bill Clinton, no fool, said this is the key to unlock the next century, build the bridge to the 21st
right.
century,
and
blow the lid off the
and
economy.
And we're waiting for it. Meanwhile, Lou Dobbs, who is no Marxist and who is no protectionist, night after night, Dennis was on tonight, has done a show called Exporting America. And no shibboleths about free trade, just the facts of the jobs lost, the communities devastated. And, you know, we're not going to, you know, it's as if they come for the manufacturing workers first, then the high-tech workers, then the back office people. And someday people are going to say, wait a minute, what's the matter with bilateral trade?
We've got Dennis Kucinich with us tonight. He joins us from Johnston, Iowa, where he's campaigning. You can join the conversation with the Democratic presidential contender, Ruth B. is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Ruth. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask, you know, I'm a voting Democrat. I try to pay attention to the presidential race. And while I don't agree with everything that's being said, I am finding your views honest, refreshing. I agree with many of them, the universal health care, the role of the UN in Iraq. And my question is, why haven't I really heard of you before? Why haven't I heard your views in this coverage before? Is it a lack of media coverage? Is it less fundraising for advertising? I just feel like, you know, your word hasn't gotten out there in the circles I run in, most of which are, you know, Democratic people who are fairly interested in politics.
So your ears are open, but you haven't heard it. Ruth B., thanks for your call and the question. Dennis Kucinich.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for calling, and of course, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be on your show. I think what's happening is people hear what I have to say. My support continues to rise. And, you know, the mainstream media has pretty much paid attention to a few candidates, and they've tried to decide the election before it's run. But as people hear my message of ending the occupation in Iraq, working with the world community, stopping a draft, not having 18-year-old women have to register, canceling NAFTA and the WTO, universal health care, they're starting to say, hey, this guy makes sense.
But there's a field of nine. The media can't really focus in on everyone with such a big field. There are front runners here. We talked with Howard Dean last week. Do you really feel you're being chosen and singled out for a kind of a quietude?
Well, let me put it this way. I taught media and politics courses at a university level, okay? I'm fully familiar with the role of the media in democratic society. And I also know that there's an attempt to try to early on determine the shape of the field. You know, unfortunately for those who have tried that, I don't conform that easily to people's expectations for getting out of a race. I'm in this race all the way, and I expect that as my candidacy continues to get more and more attention, I'm going to start to rise not only in the polls, but you'll see me continuing to be a surprise in a lot of these early primaries, and it won't take much for this campaign to catch on because I really am providing serious alternatives within the Democratic Party, a party that has failed in many ways, as Mr. Vedia said, to really provide serious direction on economic issues for the people of this country.
Standing at 2%, but guns blazing. Ruth B., thanks for your call. Paul's calling from Nahant, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. Tom, not enough for the listeners' questions. 33 minutes before the first listener's question.
Come, my friend, come. But we had to hear from the candidate himself. He's running
okay.
for the White House, huh?
Let me talk to him. Representative, I admire you. I admire your stance. You're right on NAFTA. But I differ with you. I separate from you on two points with regard to Iraq. First one is that the United Nations has never had any experience with nation building on a scale that you're proposing. Their experience has been in peacekeeping, keeping warring factions apart. The second is I'm very surprised to hear you speak against the draft. There is no greater protection against military adventurism than having a national service, including a draft.
Two good questions, Paul. Thanks very much. Dennis Kucinich.
Well, let me speak first to the UN's role. One of the reasons why the UN has had a weakened role over the years is because the United States didn't pay its dues, A, and B, the administration of George Bush has sought to do everything it can to de-emphasize the legitimacy of the United Nations.
But you think just pour in some cash and a little more, a few more strokes on Washington, and that'd be great nation building?
No, not at all, because this is about involving the world community through the United Nations. I really favor enhancing a structure of international law and cooperation. I think that's the path for the future.
But Paul's looking at history and saying the UN has no record of building, of nation building on this scale. It's a huge project.
Well, this is the moment that the UN can be fortified, and I think we ought to start thinking of that process instead of taking an offensive military posture, which NATO's transited into over the war in the Balkans. We need to have a peacekeeping force through the United Nations with a subscription from member nations that can, in effect, confirm the legitimacy of an international approach. As president, I will do that, not only through affirming the role of the United Nations, but also through signing the Biological Weapons Convention, the Chemical Weapons Convention, the Small Arm Treaty, the Landmine Treaty, joining the International Criminal Court, signing the Kyoto Climate Change Treaty. We are at a moment in human history when we need desperately to work for worldwide cooperation and to have the burden put on the entire world community of creating stability. And the idea that we're going to go it alone is a nightmare in so many ways for the future. Now, issue of the draft.
Yes, Paul says that the draft could be a barricade against military adventurism.
Well, this administration is ready to rotate another 85,000 troops into Iraq. They're ready to call up 43,000 reservists for readiness. If you talk about a draft in the context of providing more and more people to serve in Iraq, it's wrong. We're wrong to be in Iraq. We're not there for any good reason, and I wouldn't risk the life of any young men and women serving this country.
But go to the central point of Paul's question. He's saying if there's a draft, you're going to have much wider and closer public scrutiny of all military operations. It makes an Iraq less likely, not more.
Well, let me say we don't need a draft to do that. We don't need a draft to justify this administration's policies. As you indicated earlier in the program, you know, there are people who believe we should be in Iraq for quite a while. I've seen one report signed by one of the Democratic presidential candidates that projects being there at least 5 years. I don't want to be there, any more than past New Year's. I think we need to get out of Iraq. A draft would only serve to keep us in Iraq. We don't need to talk about a draft.
Paul, thanks for your call. Let's get one more call before the break. Brian's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. Love the show. What a refreshing set of perspectives. I haven't heard this in the media echo chamber in 3 years. My question is this. I'm worse off than I was 3 years ago under President Kucinich. Specifically, how do you think I'd be better off?
What's your job, Brian? What industry? What sector?
I work for a city government, but just the average American, how's my life going to be better under the policies that we're talking about today?
We've got it. Thanks for your call, Brian. Dennis Kucinich.
And I thank you for that question. Specifically, here's how. We cancel the tax cuts that go to the people in the top bracket, and we put money into a fund to create universal free public college and university tuition-free for all of America's young people. That would cost about $48 to $58 billion a year. The next thing we do is we cut the defense or the Pentagon budget by 15%. There's tremendous waste in the Pentagon. I'm on an investigative subcommittee that has jurisdiction over the Pentagon, and I can tell you we can cut 15%, $60 billion, put it right into a universal pre-kindergarten program, universal child care that would save American families $5,000 to $7,000 per child, ages 3, 4, and 5. So I give you two examples. One, college, which puts money into people's pockets. Two, pre-kindergarten, which puts money into people's pockets. And three, universal single-payer health care. Americans are going into a health care poverty because of the rising cost of premiums, co-pays, and deductibles. They're paying more and getting less. They'll have everything covered when I'm president.
Dennis Kucinich, please stand by. Brian, thanks for your call in Milwaukee. We've got to take a short break. We're talking with Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich about his political quest and his vision for the country. You can join us at 1. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich about his political quest and his vision for the country. He joins us from Johnston, Iowa, where he is in the race. The poll numbers are not great, but he's hanging right in there, ready to deliver that vision to one and all. How do you read Dennis Kucinich's view of the world? Do you share it, or is it off your map? Have the media marginalized Dennis Kucinich, or as Dennis Kucinich marginalized himself. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ed's calling from Taunton, Massachusetts. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi, Representative Kucinich. Please to hear your views. I agree with most of them, but question the ease with which you feel we might be able to exit Iraq. Just to address something that you said in the opening statement, I believe you said something to the effect of the United States troops are sitting ducks, and what we needed to do was to try to get a new resolution pushed through the UN to have UN forces take over. In light of the fact that in recent months the majority of the targets have been shifting away from U.S. forces and towards other nationals, today I believe it was the Italians, recently the Red Cross, and the fact that we've burned so much diplomatic trust and faith with other U.N. members, how do you propose to actually push this through the U.N.?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge that the U.N. will not go in unless the main focus of instability, the United States, agrees to pull out. You know, and the U.S. must renounce all political and economic interests in Iraq. And, you know, the president proved this by achieving only a symbolic vote of the U.N. with no commitment from other nations. And so my plan would phase in a U.N. force and phase out the U.S. And I think that the United States would have to pay for the rebuilding of all that we damaged in the invasion.
But that suggests, Dennis Kucinich, that the target of the insurgency in Iraq is the United States rather than Islamists, rather than Baathists who want to get back into power. I mean, why wouldn't the same people who are bombing Italians and UN headquarters and the Red Cross in the last month be bombing those same outfits 2 months from now if the U.S. troops were out in UN? Blue helmets
look,
were in
look,
there.
Look, this isn't going to be without peril for the UN. I think that's understood. But what I'm saying is that the United States presence intensifies the conflict. We already see that happening. I mean, again, you know, at the beginning of the show, there was talk of what happens with the UN. The U.S. is indulging in airstrikes right now. It's an intensification of the conflict. A U.S. general yesterday warned that a continuation of attacks on U.S. troops will meet with reprisals, which means that there's going to be an even deepening cycle of violence.
So the U.N. would do better by sitting on its hands if it gets bombed
the UN,
in Iraq?
No, I didn't say the U.N. would do better. I said that it means less violence by getting our troops out of there. It means that we can then support the UN with our financial help, but to get our troops out of there. Our troops are targets. The U.S. is an occupying army.
What would the UN be?
The UN would be the world community attempting to achieve security. The U.S. is there. Let's face it. This administration is present in Iraq in order to have access to the oil and to conduct the privatization process.
But that means you're chucking all the resistance up to a kind of nationalist sentiment in Iraq. But the reporting would indicate that there are a lot of leftovers from the Saddam Hussein regime who are angry that they've lost power and they want it back, that there are radical fundamentalist Islamists from other countries coming in there with making this the ultimate jihad.
You think the U.S. went in there and made it better? Are you asserting that? You couldn't possibly be asserting that.
I'm saying that the U.S. went in to say, yeah, we want to end tyranny in Iraq.
Oh, you know, I mean, please, you know, is that what this was about? Because that's not what we were told. We were told we were going to go in there to get the weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, now we're talking about something different. If we're going to go through everything we were told, I grant you there was a lot that was said that wasn't true.
But
Saddam Hussein was hardly a sweetheart, and he's gone.
You have to excuse me because we had no right to attack this country in the name of regime change. If we proceeded because this country was going to attack, because Iraq was going to attack us, because they were going to hit us with weapons of mass destruction, that's a right under the UN Charter. But it turned out that's not what it was about. And so I think that to try to justify it post hoc by saying, well, you know, we got rid of this nasty guy, that's not sufficient. No, the United States is a force for instability there, not stability. Our troops are at risk. As president, I would seek to do everything I could through the UN to get a UN complement in and get our troops out.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Blue helmets on the streets in Baghdad and Basra and Nasiriyah and peace descends upon Iraq?
Oh, it would be devoutly to be wished, wouldn't it? I just don't think, I mean, I think partly just on the practical matter and the political matter, we have so foul the waters with the UN, but that also for many of us, the UN is a kind of incantation. you know, it's made up of Fijians and Micronesians and a deputation from the Republic of not Liberia anymore. The point is,
and Americans and Germans and French and Chinese and Japanese.
It's true, but it simply does. I mean, we're in a war there, and. And the enemy is engaged with our forces. I agree with the congressman that we are the targets. We are the primary targets, and getting us out is their primary objective. But we're in a kind of, you know, we're in the arena now, and we've got to figure out a way to scale back. It seems to me a much better approach and much more feasible. Is the approach that Ambassador Bremer catastrophically dismissed by demobilizing the Iraqi army. To reverse that decision and let the Iraqis take charge of their own destiny, recognizing this may not be a perfect democracy, but, you know, we don't want to spend the blood and treasure that would require.
I think you're right in terms, you know, I see the UN as being a transitional force anyway. I mean, eventually, as I indicated in any resolution that would be taken to the UN, they would help to develop a cause of governance in Iraq and turn it over to the Iraqi people. That's where it has to go eventually. I see the UN as being a transition force, they aren't going to stay there and be an occupying army any more than the United States wants to be. But again, you have to realize that we conducted a war against this country, a country that did not attack us. We are in a serious and precarious position, and that's why our troops are being targeted, and that's exactly why we have to recognize this situation has deteriorated, and it's only going to escalate in its consequences for this country until we determine that we're going to get out. And the only way to do that responsibly is to embrace the world community in the cause of international cooperation and create the resolution that will enable the UN to come in.
John in Amory, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Dennis Kucinich.
Yes, hi. I applaud Dennis Kucinich. Just about brought tears to my eyes as far as what he's saying about the war in Iraq and NAFTA. I wholeheartedly agree. I wanted to make some comments about the war in Iraq. The Project for a New American Century, on their website, there's comments by Paul Wolfowitz back in September of 98 about talking about France and Russia have got sour grapes that if we go in militarily and kick the Saddam Hussein out, then they're going to have to come and deal with the new Iraqi government.
So what's the question embedded there, John?
The question is, I was curious to see if he was familiar with the Project for a New American Century and some of the rhetoric that they're putting forth.
Got it. Thanks, yes. John. Dennis Kucinich.
Yes, and certainly we know that there was an ideological plan to attack Iraq whose adherents came to power in the Bush administration. What the world didn't know is that, and what the Americans didn't know, is that the Project for the New American Century, the century they were talking about, was the 16th century of nations going against nations on the high seas. These are pirates who are masquerading as statesmen, and they really aimed to chop up Iraq like so much booty, in violation, I might add, of the Hague Convention and of the Geneva Convention. We have no right to privatize Iraq, and Paul Bremer issued a directive in September to do just that. So I'm standing very firm in saying that we should have never gone there, we have no right to be there, and we should get out of there.
No Master and Commander movie for Dennis Kucinich. Sarah's calling from Boston. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I have a question for Dennis, Representative Kucinich.
Yes.
I also agree with what you're saying in Iraq, but I have concerns about what's going on with President Bush in the environment. I was wondering, as president, what you would do to kind of rectify the things that he's been passing and the drilling and all that.
Right. Well, first of all, I would have an Environmental Protection Agency. You know, this administration has done everything it can to attack clean air and clean water standards. As president, I would see this country not only uphold the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts, but also to make a transition from non-renewable energies to renewable energies and to provide for financial incentives for the development of solar, hydrogen, geothermal, biomass, wind, and all energy technologies that are existing renewable energy and develop new energy technologies. We need to make a transition to sustainability. I'll sign the Kyoto Climate Change Treaty as a signal of solidarity with the world, but we need to move towards not just conservation, but renewable energy and a sustainable environmental policy.
President Bush would suggest that the economy can't bear that.
Well, you know what? President Bush is basically trying to privatize the air and the water and to set the cost on the American people in terms of their health. I'm going to help protect the health of the American people, protect our water and our air. And, you know, the truth is the 21st century jobs are those jobs that will help clean up the air, will help produce new energy technologies. There's these green, you know, there's these gazelles, they call these new small businesses that are really ready to spring forward and create new energy technologies. They just need a little bit of help and a little bit of incentives. We have a huge economic boom that will occur in this country in my administration because I'm going to incentivize the production of new energy technologies, of sustainability, of renewable energy as a way of not just growing our economy but of saving our planet.
Sarah, thanks for your call. Dennis Kucinich, not everybody knows your background. We've read a bit, but tell us about it. You didn't have an easy childhood. Something like 20 homes in 17 years? Have I got that right? Part of the time living out of a car?
I had an adventuresome childhood. It was, my parents never owned a home. And the family kept growing, you know, as it grew from one, the oldest me, to seven children. We kept moving from apartment to apartment. By the time I was 17, we lived in 21 different places, including a couple cars. So, you know, I kind of have an understanding of what people go through and, you know, insecurity about housing, about jobs, about education, about a lot of things.
And your dad was a union member. You're very strong pro-labor. Howard Dean just came out with some very big labor endorsements in the last couple of days. What do you make of that?
Well, I congratulate him. I can just say that, I can be true to my roots and represent working people. I live in the same house I've lived in since 1971 when I bought it for $22,000. I live in a middle class neighborhood in Cleveland, Ohio. I come from a working class background. The poet Langston Hughes once wrote, "Life for me ain't been no crystal stair." I understand that, and because of that, I can relate to people. I know what it means when people lose their job, because that's happened in my neighborhood. And I know what it means when people don't have adequate health care. I mean, these are people I grow up with. These are people I live with. So my presidency will be about, a president who really can be a president for all the people, someone who relates to people, who connects to people, and who has the aspirations of all the people at heart.
Dennis Kucinich, cast your eye down that long line, the eight other candidates. Why are you so far out on the fringe? I mean, Howard Dean says that he's the Democratic...
Whoa. Stop right there. What do you mean fringe? What's fringe about advocating universal
I have listened to the debates, and in those debates, I see the other contenders clustering at some distance from you. If you look right across that spectrum up there, I would say they're in a different place from you on Iraq, on the economy, many of them, on health care, many of them.
Well, maybe they're on the fringe. I think that my politics speak to something central in the American experience, the desire for a home, the desire for a job, the desire for...
But what I'm asking is, why aren't they there with you? What's going on with that?
Well, you know what? I just told you where I come from. I come from the neighborhoods of Cleveland. Okay, I come from an experience where, it hadn't always had it easy. And I understand what people go through.
John Edwards and some of the others, that they'll tell you their own stories.
Well, everybody has their own story, and that's important for people to know what the story is. I'm telling you mine. I'm saying that I think that my aspirations connect to the hearts of the American people. And as more people hear about my candidacy, I think I'm going to get more and more support. And I don't have to win any of these early primaries. I just have to run better than expected to start getting the attention of the nation, and I think that's going to happen.
Jack Beatty, he's in there punching.
He is, but you use the word politics, and you can see the difference between Dennis's ideas, which are fine as ideas, and Dick Gephardt, for example, on health care. Dick Gephardt's program basically is a massive tax credit for anybody who offers health care to their employers. What does that do? That builds political incentives in to the lobbying to get it done. That's a practical idea. To say universal health care without looking at that kind of politics is...
Well, Gephardt's for another night, but tonight it's Dennis Kucinich and Representative Kucinich. We're very grateful to you for spending this time with us.
Thanks for the opportunity. Please check out my website at kucinich.us.
Dennis Kucinich joined us from Johnston, Iowa. Thanks very much. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.